This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum. And today's discussion is talking about the economics and feasibility of adding storage to municipal projects. Jeff Hibsky at Clean Focus will start us out. So, Jeff, go ahead and why don't you start the discussion here.
Okay, thanks, Sierra. Yeah, this is Jeff Hibsky. I'm with Green Skies Clean Energy, a developer based in Connecticut that works primarily, have been working primarily in solar, both behind the meter and would categorize as small scale utility front of the meter projects. Pretty much work all over the U.S., although the bulk of our business is on the coasts and in particular the Northeast and California. Working for a variety of commercial type of clients, big box retailers and things like that, but probably over half of our installations have been with municipalities and school districts and public or quasi-public sector kind of projects. To date, we've installed more than about 240 megawatts of solar. And we've just are in the process of installing our first solar projects with batteries. Kind of just want to talk broadly, big picture about where what we're seeing in this battery space and as it relates to the economics, some of the fuzziness, I guess, in the economics of these things at this point yet. So, I guess broadly speaking, everyone believes, and certainly the market analysts and stuff, that this is going to be a very strong, very rapidly growing market. Makes sense from a technical perspective. The as grids get more and more penetration of renewables, and prices of battery storage or storage in general, but batteries in particular, start coming down further and further, the economics just start to make more and more sense. And like I mentioned, technically it might be a requirement to really do storage as penetrations in sections of the grid get higher and higher. You just can't support more intermittent type of resources without some type of effectively a buffer to allow that to happen. So, I think everyone believes in this space it's going to happen. And again, the economics are starting to become compelling on a number of different applications. But I would caveat that with there is no one killer application yet, from an economic point of view, at least that we've run across. And I think what's we're in this state of the market where the technology is good and certainly is starting to get deployed at relatively large scales. But the structure of these deals and from a commercial economic side is still very much being worked out and trying to find the best market models, best applications. And the reality is, I think right now is there's a number of applications that are good, and there are no applications that are great or that are slam dunks. They do require some amount of finesse and or some amount of faith that the energy prices are going to move in a certain direction or whatever the case may be. With the caveat that in a couple of places there are pretty attractive incentives. At a utility/state level, and the incentives really push the economics to something that makes a lot of sense. But unsubsidized or unless the subsidies are strong enough, the economics really relate to what broadly speaking is called value stacking, and basically taking a little bit of economics from energy savings and a little bit from demand reduction savings and participating in the grid services markets and taking a little bit of money from everything to make the overall economics look really attractive. And so I think we're kind of in that state of the market. That being said, you know, almost all of the projects in California and a good portion, particularly the municipal projects in the Northeast, we're starting to see either a requirement or a request for an option for storage and what the economics of what a price would be with and without storage. So clearly it's something that's, you know, we're at the beginning of what we see as a very strong and important market phase. As I kind of alluded to it, but we kind of really see there's three main revenue/economic drivers in this space. Probably if anyone's familiar with the overall market storage, none of these are probably new or earth shattering, but one is demand charge reduction. They're reducing peak demand charges in some geographies, both in the East and the West. There can be very high demand charges, whether it be retail or wholesale. So, again, this is either front of the meter or behind the meter type of applications. In some utilities or some tariffs and use profiles, those savings can pay for the battery just on their own. You don't need any of this deal stacking. You don't need to do any kind of financial trickery. You know, if you've got very spiky load that occurs a few times a day with a relatively small size battery, you can clip the top of those demand peaks pretty effectively and save a significant amount of money. On the other hand, if you've got a load that looks more like a retail center where other than maybe the occasional air conditioning motor turning on, you have a relatively flat or constant kind of load, it's pretty hard to put a big enough battery in to significantly impact your demand charges. So that is very much an application type of installation at this point or application. Second place where there's obviously revenue to be had is in the grid services market, and there's two different sides of that. The capacity markets that are in a couple of the ISOs that will pay for basically being available at a standby basis or to be called upon when the larger grid needs that capacity, either because you're in very high load conditions or there might be a perturbation on the grid, a large plant needs to go down or something for maintenance or some kind of critical situation. You'll get paid for having so many megawatts of your capacity available for immediate dispatch if called upon. And then the second part of grid services is the often called ancillary services, but it's effectively voltage and current stabilization. Rapid changes in the grid, be it from loads ramping up quickly or ramping down quickly, or supplies ramping up and down quickly, can cause voltages to typically sag, but not sometimes even spike if it's a load that's dropped. And same thing for frequency, and the grids are both mandated by law as well as, or I guess, by regulation, and as well as for the safety of the grid, have a very tight band that they need to operate in. And so having a battery storage kind of resource on the grid that's certainly large enough can provide a really interesting thing, because it can provide both a load and or a source. And so depending on, as well as it can respond very quickly. It's not a type of source or resource that takes time to ramp up. So it's ideally suited for this frequency and voltage control type of application. The downside being is that's not a huge revenue source. The amount of money that the grid operators pay for those kind of applications are pretty small, relatively speaking. And so you're likely not going to get enough money out of the grid operators just on that application alone to justify the economics of any kind of battery. And then the third main application or third place where there is money to be made or economics to be derived is in effectively energy arbitrage. And this is, basically charging your batteries, when electricity prices are low and discharging them when electricity prices are high. And again, in the wholesale application, if you are paying, the wholesale price real time or 15 minute ahead type of pricing, you could have some pretty severe spikes for, a very short period of time, 1-15 minute interval or maybe, an hour or two, during high load times. And if you have enough battery storage that you can, pull energy from for your need, you can help mitigate that. The economics aren't there to put in a giant size battery, so you're effectively not taking any power from the grid. But if you can reduce what you're taking from the grid during those very high price times, it can certainly save you money. And again, for a municipal utility, that is buying at least some portion of their power from third parties or from the wholesale market, that becomes potential real big savings, at least 10 times a year or 20 times a year when you have these wild price perturbations. So those are the three areas really when we are talking particularly municipalities and the front of the meter or even behind the meter in some cases, the type of discussions we're having about the economics. And then I just want to touch briefly, and then I'll stop talking and kind of let other people give their thoughts. I kind of touched on this, but what I would call the procurement model or the commercial models are really in flux right now. How do you pay for these? How do you acquire them? I think if we look at where the solar industry was maybe 10 years ago, there was a lot of different economic models. PPAs were starting to become a standard type of thing, but were still not widely accepted and not necessarily easy to get funded. Now it's sort of one of the two default purchase modes. You either buy it under or procure solar under a power purchase agreement, or you buy the system. In the battery space, we're not there yet. There's all kinds of developing models. None of them, I would say, have been settled upon. Obviously, you can still do a direct purchase. Sort of where I think the majority of batteries today are being installed and is under some type of energy service agreement. And that broadly is, we'll install the batteries for you, these battery manufacturers or energy service companies, and we'll operate it and participate in some of these wholesale markets. We'll do the energy arbitrage as appropriate. And whatever money we save, you will share with you. There's maybe a 40-60 split or 50-50 split. And so there's no upfront capital yet. You're giving away the some of your savings, because you don't have necessarily the expertise and or the wherewithal to really participate in these wholesale markets if that's where you're going to generate some or all of your value. The third is sort of becoming more common but still not widespread is a PPA that includes the battery storage. This again requires the third party, the owner of the system, and this again is almost always paired with solar or wind, we will provide power at X pennies per kilowatt hour, but we can provide it over a broader time frame than you could if it was just solar, and or you can actually provide it cheaper because you're going to participate in some of these wholesale markets and take the revenue from that and use that revenue to offset the cost of the batteries and therefore, you know, provide a better deal, if you will, under the PPA. So, and as I mentioned, I don't think any of these have become the standard model yet. And it depends a little bit on the sophistication of the end user, depends a little bit on, you know, the stomach to really get in there and operate these things if you're participating in the wholesale markets, et cetera, et cetera. So with that, I'll kind of put myself on mute and take questions, comments. I don't know, Sierra, if anyone else is going to speak before we open it up.
We have Rick's here, but I also wanted to mention for people on the phone, please put your phones on mute because we were having some background noise. And Richard Chase, I muted your phone. So I will unmute it, but please make sure your phone's on mute. So, okay. So Rick Brown's here. Rick, do you have anything to add to this?
Good morning. Yeah.
Rick from Terra Verde Energy. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just this is Rick. Yeah, good to talk to you all. Excellent overview, really, really good overview. I'm going to drill down, though, into some more specifics related to the California situation. And a lot of stuff has been hopping recently, so this is, you know, maybe new information for a lot of people. But just in terms of background of Terra Verde, we're an independent energy advisor. We've been around for 10 years. We've supported primarily public agencies, schools, cities, water agencies, transit districts, and more recently, last 3 years, been working with CCAs, particularly on their development of DER programs to deploy behind-the-meter resources that touch both the customer benefit, but also some of that kind of wholesale and load management needs that that CCAs have that, I forget the name the previous speaker was talking about, I apologize. But in terms of what's going on currently, at the state level in California, the California Public Utilities Commission issued a ruling recently that's going to go into effect actually this week for residential customers and on April 1st for non-residential customers, an update to the self-generation incentive program, which is the incentive for battery storage in California. The changes relate to providing extra adders or extra incentives for batteries that are located in disadvantaged communities or low-income communities and serve those locations, medical baseline customers, as well as batteries that are being deployed, particularly for municipal facilities that provide resiliency or backup during grid outages. And as many of you know, besides the natural disaster or really climate disaster-based grid outages, we have now the public safety power shutoff dynamic that is impacting large swaths of California to prevent wildfire risks. So that program is just rolling out now. If you want, it's very unfortunately the CPUC decided that simple is not the way to go, and it's a very complex set of requirements. If you want to get an overview of that, we have just published today a blog that goes into detail on the different categories of incentives and how you qualify for them. So you can just go to put in TerraBlog, T-E-R-R-A-B-L-O-G, and you can see the article that kind of lays out all those different things. The other important thing, though, to note is that recently this in December, three different CCAs in California and a public utility banded together to put out an RFP for battery resources to support the, both resilience and resource adequacy, which is one of those, you know, wholesale market type things that was being discussed. And those RFPs are, I think, just the first of many that are going to come out from the CCA community to provide incentives that capture these different needs, the resilience needs for municipal facilities, as well as the wholesale market needs that was referenced. Another important example, we were engaged by Sonoma Clean Power, which is the CCA, the second oldest CCA, and one that serves Sonoma County and Mendocino County, which are locations that have been hit hardest by wildfires and PSPS events. they engaged us to do an analysis of 37 municipal facilities that currently have solar, and our analysis to look at addition of batteries and obviously microgrid controllers to create resilience at those facilities and also provide some of these other benefits. The value stacking issue is problematic there in that in those facilities are almost uniformly under what's known as an A6 rate structure, which has no demand charges. So those batteries will not be able to generate for those customers that particular value. So figuring out how to make those work economically between the SGIP incentive, potential incentives from the CCA is going to be an interesting issue, an interesting problem. Now, in that regard, a third piece that I do want to mention is new legislation. And there's three bills that were introduced a week ago last Friday that are really important to be tracking. And ultimately, if you're in California, I think to be supporting. One is called the Resilient Schools Bill. And this is a bill carried by Assemblymember Phil Ting, who happens to be the chair of the Assembly Budget Committee. And so this bill is likely to become a budget rider. And it would fund schools on a priority basis related to both low income and risks around PSPS or natural disasters, but would fund up to about 1,000 schools around California to have batteries and microgrid controllers paired with their existing solar, or in some cases it'll fund adding solar to create resilience at those schools, both for the purposes of providing a place of shelter for kids when there are PSPS or other events and the parents need their kids to go somewhere while they go to work, particularly first responders, but also potentially emergency resource centers for cooling, for refrigeration of medicines, for plug loads, et cetera. So that's a major initiative. And in parallel, there is underway in the governor's office looking at a similar kind of initiative, but that would be broader in terms of not just schools, but potential municipal facilities, and also potentially include use of electric buses as mobile battery resources during grid outages. A second bill, and so that's bill AB 3021. A second bill, AB 3251, by Assemblymember Rebecca Bauer-Kahan, would increase the ability of behind-the-meter storage at municipal and other facilities to serve as capacity resources in these wholesale markets that were being talked about. Currently, there are several significant obstacles in both California Independent System Operator and CPUC regulations to those resources being able to bid into those markets. This bill would sort of crash through those regulations and say, come on, let's figure out how to make these resources available because they're low cost, they're more resilient, they're more distributed, they're a better answer than a centralized approach to resource adequacy and other grid needs. So that bill would basically increase the value of behind-the-meter batteries in California, which would add to the value stacking equation that was discussed previously. And the third bill, which is particularly important to municipals, is a bill aimed at local governments, and it would basically provide technical assistance funding for local governments to put together community resiliency plans. The idea being that every community in California at this point, be it wildfires, be it floods, be it earthquakes, needs to have a community energy resiliency plan. And this would provide technical assistance funding from the cap and trade program to allow cities to and or counties to put together those plans in anticipation, I'm imagining, of in following years, there may be budget funding in following years for implementing those plans, but there is likely to be a ballot measure in November, somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 to $6 billion, to provide infrastructure funding for resiliency, and that money would probably be the source for building the infrastructure, providing support to local communities to implement those community resiliency plans. So that's SB 1314, Senator Bill Dodd, who happens to represent parts of Sonoma County, where these impacts have been the greatest in the last few years. So those three bills, AB 3251, AB 3021 and SB 1314, plus the bond measure going on the ballot in November, are all initiatives that will essentially create greater funding, greater ability for local governments and schools to truly implement these resiliency approaches and, again, provide these other benefits in terms of non-wire alternatives and load-shaping alternatives to clean energy alternatives to what the current standard model is. So stay tuned. These are major initiatives, and we'll be also reporting on what we're doing with Sonoma Clean Power in terms of that analysis, because we think that model is one that other CCAs are likely to follow.
Very interesting. I hope this is a trend throughout the country to move in that direction. It sounds very important. So anybody have any comments about this? Jeff, do you want to comment about it? Or?
Not specifically. I know, the California marketplace for storage is crazy dynamic right now. There's things moving in the right direction. Like you said, some of this legislation, participating in the capacity or some of these grid services markets isn't allowed for batteries in California. Getting some of that stuff in place is great. Some of the changes in the commercial tariff structures and basically shifting the peak time of use to afternoon and evening, and because they're running out of terms, they're calling super off-peak rates in the spring and fall during midday when solar generation effectively is making wholesale prices in the California grid zero or in some cases negative, has really hurt the economic value of solar by itself. But you put storage back on and shift the generation to the afternoon, and the economics start looking very positive again. And so you've kind of got this push-pull of things that are going on in California that, I would say, makes things look very interesting and promising. And Jerry mentioned, some of the resiliency things and the incentives for putting storage in really, really makes it an interesting market, but I'd say it's far from a slam dunk in a lot of applications today. But I think over the next 2 to 3 years, as these things really start to roll out, we're putting a real emphasis on some of these type of things, and starting to, these are 2-3 year long type of deals, particularly with CCAs and municipalities. You got to start working on them now if you want to install stuff in 2023. So that's the way we're kind of taking the approach.
Let me throw one more comment in that your comment just mentioned, if you don't mind, Sierra. One of the dynamics in the solar market, somebody was referencing where things were 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the cost of solar was probably, just panels themselves in California was at least 3, if not 4 times greater than it is today. The cost of capital was 2 to 3 times greater than it is today. One of the things that's going to make batteries take off and make the economics work is drops in the cost of the equipment itself and drops in the cost of capital behind its equipment. We've seen gradual declines in the cost of batteries, and the cost of capital is not quite as high as it was for solar 10 years ago. But there still is, some hesitancy out there in the capital markets as to, where this is at. My hope and my belief is that with these kinds of initiatives that hopefully are going to come through the California legislature and from the voters, with these bond measures, with these new incentives, with this huge push really caused by, the crises of wildfires and PSPS, with that increase in demand, that the suppliers will start, ramping up their ability to create scale economies around production of batteries such that pricing will come down. And I've talked to some of the, major players and some of the distributors who do believe that we're going to finally see some of those more significant cost reductions in battery storage coming in the next couple of years. And we also need, and then, you know, capital markets are the most conservative. And once they see, you know, these batteries, you know, we've only in California allowed behind the meter batteries since 2014. And capital markets generally don't start to think about an asset as being something worth investing in until you've had 5 years of, you know, risk-adjusted good experience. So we're now at that 5 to 6 year point. Hopefully capital markets will start to, you know, do what we need them to do to bring those costs down also. If we get that dynamic going like we did with solar, then, you know, the kind of incentives that we're having to put out there to juice things will be less critical. And we'll see the same kind of dynamic. You know, wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, excess energy storage 10 years from now, like we have, you know, like was just mentioned around solar. So that's sort of the other dynamic going on here, which is that price and capital cost dynamic.
All right. Do we have anybody who would like to comment about this? Questions?
This is Craig Lewis. I came on late, so I apologize if it's been talked about already. But Rick, you're so far out in the lead on so many of these considerations. I'm wondering if you have any rule of thumb guidance in terms of how the economics pencil based on existing value streams. You know, the time of use arbitrage, the demand charge management. You know, that those would be behind the meter type of installations. And then kind of what the gap is to have solar and storage providing a solar microgrid. And to me, that gap really represents the amount that people need to consider as being the value of resilience. And obviously, the solar and the storage need to be sized in order to provide resilience. But if you've got any solar and storage working together, you can obviously configure things to provide some level of resilience. It might only be 10% of the load you could have indefinite resilience on, but you could have some level of resilience for your most critical loads. So I'll just kind of leave it at that. But can you provide any color to that?
Yeah.
One comment here. This is Sierra. One comment. Jeff, I think you also would probably want to weigh in on that question. So Craig didn't hear your part of it.
Yep.
So go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I unfortunately, it is really hard to give a rule of thumb on that gap because the differences that exist in different territories, particularly between between PG&E and the other IOUs around this issue of demand charges and the availability of demand charge shaving as an economic value doesn't exist in PG&E territory for most commercial customers who are, you know, putting their systems in under A6 because that A6 is a solar friendly rate. Now that will likely go away in a few years, so it'll be more of a level playing field around that. But even in Edison territory or SDG&E territory where there are significant demand charges, it really varies by, as I think Jeff mentioned earlier, by spikiness of load. And so there really isn't a good rule of thumb overall. You have, say, a water treatment plant that may have a very brick-like demand profile, right, where you have high demand for several hours and then minimal demand the rest of the day. Well, a battery's not going to do much to shave your peak load there. But you may have a police station that, you know, has, you know, 6-7 months out of the year when the AC is cranking in the afternoon and has a spike that can be shaved. Then the economics are going to look pretty good. So for the moment, I think it's really hard to say that there are rule of thumbs around those gaps. I think the best solution there is what, you know, which is my mantra, which is measure twice, cut once. You got to do the analysis. And, you know, for example,
we are about to roll out a program using software we've developed to identify what's the optimal sizing of a battery system for a school and or municipal facility. Luckily, we've been able to create a tool that is, you know, gives a quick and dirty, a back of the envelope analysis that at least can tell you in the range of, you know, plus or minus 10-15%, what is the optimal battery size and what are the likely economics, you know, based on a particular territory. Now, you would never do a procurement based on that rule of, you know, that sort of back of the envelope analysis, but at least it gives you a sense of what the, you know, optimal sizing would be and what the economics would be under that optimal sizing. And then if you decide as a municipal, you know, decision maker, okay, that's close enough that I'm ready to go to the next step, then you do the more fine-grained analysis that, you know, looks at, you know, much more detail around what your critical loads are and where you want to target that. And how that intersects, how the battery sizing associated with that intersects with the different value streams that Jeff had talked about in terms of what can it provide. And then that'll tell you what that gap might be, the specific gap might be, that either can be filled with a CCA incentive, a SGIP incentive, or hopefully some of these new incentives that are coming from the legislature. Now, that's California. I don't know what to tell you about other locations.
Jeff, any comments on that?
Yeah, so this is Jeff. I guess just a couple of things broadly on it. One is just, you know, in California, actually, or in PG&E, larger commercial and or municipal operations do have demand charges on their E19 and E20 rate schedule, which are now shifting to V19 and V20. But so there are significant demand charges, and so if there's a commercial or municipal customer that has a high enough load that they don't qualify or didn't qualify for that A6 rate, there are options just for demand charge savings, again, if their load is right. But, yeah, I just kind of want to amplify that there. I would say there's not a single rule of thumb either that really, you know, you could pin, well, if we have an incentive of X number of dollars per kilowatt hour, because the application – And this value stacking and stuff is so different, you know, anywhere you are, and even within, you know, a different utility in the same state, it can be different. You know, in the Northeast, to make the economics work out, broadly speaking, you likely have to be participating in some of the wholesale or grid services markets. The, you know, just savings from demand charges and or energy arbitrage is probably not enough to pay directly for the battery, but if you can participate in wholesale markets as well, then the economics start to look pretty attractive in the right cases. You know, California is really difficult, if not impossible, to participate right now in the wholesale markets, but with the right load profile and under the right, you know, energy tariff, just demand charge savings alone or demand charge savings and energy arbitrage can pay for the, you know, the economics of the battery. And so, you know, I totally agree. There's no one size fits all. It's hardly even, when we are working with some of our clients on these things, it ends up, you have to go into a deep dive. You've got to get, you know, 15 minute interval data for the meters that you're looking at and really understand how your batteries are going to interact with that. And, what changes could be made maybe in the load profile to optimize that as well. And it's certainly much more complicated than solar by itself. Let's put it that way. It takes more time. It takes a lot more back and forth with the end users as well. So
does somebody who has not had a chance to talk have a question?
Yeah, this is Jerry Braun. Very comprehensive and very valuable discussion in all three inputs, Jeff and Rick and Craig. The one thing that comes to mind is the federal incentives that are available for solar. I'm not I don't have a clear picture of how they apply to, solar plus battery storage. But I would be interested in comments on the fact that they are starting to ratchet down. This 2020 was the first year. How does that affect the outlook for financing these applications, value stacking or not?
This is Jepson. Broadly, the federal incentives, the investment tax credit, is more complicated with storage as well, because it really depends on the configuration of your system. At least 75% of the charging has to come from a renewable source, solar typically, to claim ITC at all. And then, it kind of is pro rata to the amount above 75% that you can claim. And then you have things like in California, if you're taking or claiming ITC, then your SGIP incentive goes down, relatively speaking. And so there's lots of interplays on how these incentives work together or work against each other. And so, again, I'd say there's no one-size-fits-all answer there. Obviously, as ITC starts to step down, it will drive the economics negative. But, I think, as was mentioned, as battery prices come down, and I think the other place that really there's a lot of work that, is being done is in the balance of system costs as well. How do you put in the proper controllers? And, there are now inverters available that can connect both the solar and the battery together, or two-way inverter, if you will. DC-coupled systems, if you're in front of the meter, start to make a lot more sense. So these kind of things, I think, are really going to drive down costs and probably drive them down faster than the federal incentive steps down, at least over the next couple of years. So for us, it's not a major consideration is the value of the incentive. Obviously, the more the better, but the economics are driven so much more by other items that it's not a major part of our calculus when we're doing these things.
And one other comment, which is that I wouldn't necessarily assume that the step down in ITC is going to occur if we elect a Democratic president and Democratic Senate and hold the House. So just a little political advocacy right there. The second is that actually I didn't mention another bill in California, which is a tax credit bill related to California taxes for energy storage. There's two bills, actually, including one from a Republican senator. I don't have the numbers handy, but two bills that would provide tax credits, primarily focused on residential, although we're working to get them available for municipal through third party type financing structures. So those bills were specifically constructed to fill the gap that exists because of the federal step down. So I don't know to what extent, tax credit bills are tough to get through California legislature. I'm less optimistic, but they are out there.
Thank you.
Anybody else? No? Any other comments on this topic at all? Craig?
Well, I will. I won't miss that opportunity since you're welcoming me so nicely, Sierra. The one thing I'll mention is that the Clean Coalition is working on solar microgrids for the Santa Barbara Unified School District, which has 21 campuses throughout the Santa Barbara area, and we are very much focused on the resilience piece of it. So we will be doing the pure economic value based on the traditional value stack, and also doing the resilience analysis. Our rule of thumb is that we aim to be able to keep at least 10% of the normal load on 100% of the time. So there's essentially a critical load budget at each of the schools of 10% of their normal load, and that will be comprised of things like the refrigerators and the communication systems and the multipurpose rooms where people generally would gather for reacting to disasters and potentially emergency sheltering and provisioning and all that good stuff. So more to come soon. We aim to have an RFP, request for proposal, designed by within the next 30 to 45 days. And once that hits the street, everybody can see how we have sized the solar and the storage and the assumed economics around those, because we're getting very detailed in the RFP design to make sure that whoever's going to build on and operate these systems is only going to put a proposal in if they can hit the benchmarks.
Sherry or Mark?
Had a comment about this is one of the areas that we struggle with, is this value of resiliency. Right now there's no, at least that is generally accepted, model of what is resiliency worth. And we've talked to a number of different clients about, and it'll provide us some backup, and like you said, 10% of the load, critical load, whatever the amount of it is. And so the battery ends up being XYZ. It costs, so many dollars, and all of a sudden they go, well, that doesn't, how am I going to get my money back on that? And, there is no easy answer, because it might be a once-in-5-year, once-in-10-year type occurrence. And so the valuing that resiliency has been a very difficult thing in this marketplace, at least so far.
That's very true, and I'll just give you some numbers for one of the high schools in the Santa Barbara Unified School District. We're going to have to reserve a minimum state of charge in the battery of about 10% in order to provide the level of resilience that I mentioned. That it just so happens that it's 10% reserve on the battery in the case of having enough solar to net zero the whole school, and then having 2 hours energy storage on that amount of solar gets us to where we need to reserve about 10% of the battery. So 90% of the battery gets to be cycled daily, and so you get that everyday economic value from the 90% of the battery that capacity that you do get to use. You're only reserving 10% of it. But you're right. That last comment was correct. That 10% reserve is sitting there idle, and is not getting used daily for economic value. But it's a very small percentage of the overall battery capacity.
I'd like to invite either Sherry or Mark to join the conversation. Do you have anything to add to this, either one of you? Nope. Okay. All right, go ahead. We have a couple more minutes left here. Anybody?
Well, I'll just, maybe we can wrap up early, but I do encourage people who want to understand the complexities of the SCHIP incentive for batteries for non-residential to, I'll just repeat again, terrablog.com. We worked really hard, worked closely with CPUC staff and other people to make sure we got the numbers right. It kind of provides some navigation for figuring out, if you have a municipal facility, what level of incentive can you get? And if you are interested in having a analysis of what the optimal sizing and general economics would be for your facility, with what we call our mega charge software. I don't know where we came up with that name, but anyway, just get in touch, and we'll be glad to see if we can give you that analysis. That's a
hey, Rick. That's a very generous offer. Did you know that the new SJP handbook was published yesterday?
Yeah, and we checked our, that's why we waited until today to put our stuff out to check to see what's in there, and so, you know, it's consistent with that. The problem is the handbook is you have to be a geek to read that handbook. The other part is that there's some definite, I'll just add, there's some things that are very unclear in the handbook. I had a conversation with the CPUC commissioner, both last, Cliff Rexhoffen, who oversaw this proceeding around this SCIP at a conference last week, and then through email the last few days. For example, how does a public facility get designated as a eligible community resource center? And if it's designated as a community resource center, it has then it can apply for certain incentives that if it doesn't get designated, it doesn't get to apply for those incentives. The goofiness, I would say, of where they are right now is that the local investor-owned utility, if it designates you as an emergency resource center, then you're eligible for a certain extra incentive. If you are a public facility and get designated as a cooling center, meaning a place where people can go on very hot days when there's outages, then you qualify under a different set of rules. And that designation is from the local government. Well, there's a number of local governments who are going to be challenging the idea that their local IOU has a better understanding of where a local resiliency center ought to be located. And so anyway, there's, yes, the handbook is out. It's difficult to interpret at best. And there are some issues that are going to still be adjudicated. Let's put it that way. But you know, we're not what we've determined, and other people in the industry have determined. We're not going to submit a formal challenge to the current handbook because we don't want to delay this program going. We've seen so many delays so far, but we are going to be working to get it clarified and updated over the next few months.
Great. And by the way, did you say that you have a tool that you can do some kind of basic analysis using? And if so, can you repeat what the link was?
The tool is not a downloadable tool. It's something where we would have to, you know, gather people's energy data and plug it in and do some analysis. It's not, unfortunately, it's not a place where it can just plug and play. So just if you're interested, you have people, Craig, who are interested, just have them contact either through that TerraBlog site, there's a link, or, you know, you can just refer people to me and I'll send them on to who they need to talk to.
Cool. Okay, thanks.
Okay. A few minutes more. All right. Okay, so we have tomorrow, Jeff is going to be having a webinar discussing the same topic, economics and feasibility of adding storage to municipal projects. So if you have a chance to attend that, it'll be in more detail than today's discussion. And on March 9th, we have a discussion on educational institutions working on community energy programs. And there are several people from universities who will be attending and on the panel for that. So, hope to see you all next time. Thanks for coming. Excellent discussion. And thanks again to the panel. Really good talk. It sounds like there's some interesting progress being made out in California, at least.
By the way, Sierra, is the webinar tomorrow, is that part of your group? Because I don't see that in my calendar.
It's definitely tomorrow. And, yes, I am hosting it.
Can you should send have out another email about it with the WebCon details, whatever, how you access it?
Okay, I'll send an email out to everybody in the group. But you should have emails coming through, not through Sierra Dahl, but through my other service that I use for emails for the webinars. It's separate from the group.
Yeah,
but definitely I can do that.
And then event, it would automatically populate my calendar either way, but I don't see anything in here.
Okay. I'll do that. It'd be more of an email than a calendar invitation, so.
Oh, that's probably the problem. Okay.
Yeah. But I'll go ahead and send that out today then. All right. Thanks again.
Very good.
See you all next time. All right now.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.